Joan, and we're on agenda paper five.
In agenda paper five, we analyzed the comments received on the tentative agenda decision regarding the classification of liability for a prepaid card in the issuer's financial statements. We received five responses. All the respondents agree with the tentative agenda decision not to add this issue to its agenda. However, two respondents suggested more clarification on the scope, and one respondent suggested a more substantial review of the derecognition requirement in different standards. And another respondent thought that the agenda decision should be revised. On the basis of which step analysis on those suggestions in this paper, we recommend the finalization of this tentative agenda decision. Our proposed wording is shown in Appendix A to this paper, and it reflects the suggested wording of the respondents. Our question is whether you agree with our recommendation to finalize the agenda decision and to make wording changes.
Tony?
I guess it will come as no surprise to anybody to find that I disagree with the staff recommendation. I've got, I think, three comments on the proposed, or probably two comments on the proposed agenda decision and one observation. Obviously, there was a comment that suggested another way of looking at it. I think the staff's analysis of that comment missed the point made in the comment letter. So the comment letter did not suggest that these things are not financial liabilities. The comment letter agreed that they meet the definition of a financial liability. The argument in the comment letter was that they don't meet the definition of a financial instrument and therefore fall outside the scope of IS 39. So at the point at which one of these cards is issued, the holder does not have a right to cash. The holder only has a right to use the card to pay for things. So the holder has a right to goods, not cash. And so the suggestion in the comment letter was that puts these outside the scope of IS 39 because they're not financial instruments. Liability on one, financial liability on one side, non-financial asset on the other. And that arguing that it is outside the scope of IS 39 allows entities to choose an accounting policy that reflects the economics rather than being driven by the demand deposits guidance. So that was the suggestion, and I don't think that was captured in the analysis in the paper. So, and since I'm obviously getting the chance to go first this time, we're interested in other people's observations on that and whether anybody else sees any merits in that as a way of looking at the question. And so, like you obviously heard me say before, the objective is to allow people to arrive at an accounting solution that reflects the economic substance rather than getting driven by the demand deposit guidance in IS 32. My other two observations get to the agenda decision itself. I agree with the suggestion by the ISBJ that the agenda decision shouldn't apply to an award that can be a card that can be redeemed with the entity. Because I think that if the entity issues a card that can be redeemed for goods or services, then to me that's getting really close to something that ought to be accounted for in the revenue standards. And you end up with the odd situation that if I've got a store and I've got a franchise next door, I issue a card that can be cashed in for goods here or at the franchise, and I get pushed into financial instruments accounting, which doesn't make sense to me. So I would be inclined to agree with that and delete the reference to maybe, which may include the entity. And lastly, the agenda decision suggests that if you've got one of these cards that's partly in a customer, or it's part of a customer loyalty plan, but it also meets the definition of the scope here, you'd end up bifurcating it. And that seems like a level of complexity way too far to me. I understand the theory behind it. If you get to the conclusion here, you'd say, well, part of this is a customer loyalty and part of it gets accounted for like it was a demand deposit. But I just wonder if making that explicit is a step too far. So I don't support the agenda decision, which won't come as any surprise to anybody. Be interested in what other people have to say.
Reinhardt?
Michael wanted to come in real quickly.
Sorry, just on your first point, Tony. I disagree that with regards to us not taking the point on that was raised in the PwC comment letter about it not being a financial instrument. I think that that was part of the discussion at the September meeting, and I recall you raising that as one of the discussions. And so what we reflected on and reflected in the paper was that we felt that that point had been raised. I know IS8 itself hadn't been discussed at the September meeting, but the argument that this wasn't a financial instrument was discussed, and still the committee concluded that it should be accounted for as a financial liability.
I think my point, Michael, is that the announcement paper says there's another financial asset meaning the obligation of a financial liability. That wasn't the point that was made in the comment. It was accepting its financial liability, but because there's no financial asset, that means there's no financial instrument. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it falls outside of scope.
Point taken. Point understood, not taken. Reinhardt?
Those of us on the call could not hear that last comment. Could you repeat, please?
Yeah, we have some construction noise, unfortunately, outside. Tony, you want to take an abbreviated crack at it? I think the last point was...
Just the last point. So, yeah, I just came back to Michael and said that I thought the analysis in the staff paper said that they disagreed that it wasn't a financial liability because there wasn't a financial asset. Fine. The point that was made in the response was to argue that there isn't a financial instrument because there isn't a financial asset, and therefore an argument that it's not in the scope of 39.
Reinhardt?
In terms of my thoughts on this issue, I would agree with the staff that from the perspective of the issuer of this prepaid card, that it is a financial liability, but I also think it is within the scope of IS 39, because I think to argue otherwise is to say that there are two different stages to the event. On issuance of the prepaid card, the issuer obviously got cash and has to determine what to classify that amount of cash, and the issuer stands ready to honor the obligation that the issuer has to the merchant.
Have left the conference.
So the issuer stands ready to honor the obligation that it has to the merchant once the customer comes and redeems the prepaid card for goods or services. So I do think it's within the scope of IS 39 and would agree with the staff analysis on that. Having said that, though, I do agree with Tony's other two points. Firstly, I believe it would be good for us to go back to the original question which was asked, which was that the issuer, its only obligation is to pay cash to a third-party merchant once that prepaid card is redeemed, and not to include instances where the issuer might also provide goods or services, because I think that complicates the issue unnecessarily, or not unnecessarily, it complicates the issue, and we haven't really fully discussed the interplay in that circumstance. So I would propose, along with Tony, going back to where we were originally. My recollection is that we expanded the scope to include circumstances where the issuer might also stand or provide potentially goods or services, because that was along the lines of where the EITF scope went. But having said that, the EITF came to a different conclusion. They've also included circumstances where the holder of the card could redeem for cash, so it includes things like traveler's checks, etc. So I think, as it's a long way around of saying, I would agree with Tony and the ASBJ to go back to circumstances where the issuer has no obligation other than to pay cash to the third-party merchant. And then I also agree with Tony's last point in terms of we seem to be confusing the issue with customer loyalty programs. On the one hand, item number F tries to exclude circumstances where a customer loyalty program is part of or embedded within the prepaid card, and yet later on we say in the proposed addition that if there is something embedded it should be analyzed separately. And like Tony, I agree that we haven't really talked about that, and that by saying that, it is seems contradictory with the background facts, and also secondly doesn't provide any guidance as to how one might do that analysis and separation.
So you would propose essentially none of the staff suggested edits and just go with the original?
I'd sent in some proposed edits along the lines of what I just said, which I think the primary edits would be to item number D, to make it explicit that it's only the issuer has no obligation to provide goods or services, and really the cardholder can only redeem a third party's. And I do agree with number F, or I had a couple of minor wording changes to F to clarify that a customer loyalty program is not embedded within the plan, but I would also agree that we don't need that last paragraph.
The last paragraph, which is an add.
Yeah.
Okay. Carl?
I agree with the amendments, and I think it does provide more clarity, and I agree with the staff recommendation to finalize this issue.
Okay. Bonnie?
I had similar comments to Tony, and when I read through all of the comment letters, I actually thought that the PwC comment letter had a rather elegant solution, which I think better reflects the economic substance of a lot of these cards, where holding an obligation on the books for sometimes in perpetuity if there's no expiration date seems a bit counterintuitive to me. So I agree with Tony that I think there's merit to that argument. I also had a lot of heartburn with the very last sentence, which talks about the customer loyalty programs, and if there is one embedded, it needs to be bifurcated. To me, it's extremely unclear as to how one might go about doing that. And I think that also adds a level of complexity to this agenda decision, which raises more questions rather than clarifies anything.
Okay. Mikhail.
Yes, I generally agree with the staff here, and also when it comes to this proposal of harmonizing this requirements in the IS 39 and IS 37, because I believe that it should not be an exception for this type of cards if we say that they are no expiration date. I would assume that the best solution to that is to actually have expiration dates and avoid an accounting problem, so to speak. It's more of a business problem. But then, of course, it would be preferable to have consistent principles in the different standards, and then you also would have had a better solution, maybe. But I still agree with the staff's solution and the proposed agenda decision.
Okay, regarding that final paragraph that the staff has added, would you support keeping that or taking it out?
Actually, I thought that was a little bit difficult to understand, so I would actually prefer to take it out as well, if that would be the proposal.
Okay. Young-Soo?
All right. Actually, I have three comments. The first comment is the same comment as Tony made. The second comment of Tony's. I also agree with Tony that this card should not be redeemable to the entity. If we do so, then this card creates something other than financial liability, I believe. Something like unearned revenue or very similar to the loyalty program. So I agree with the Tony, also the ASBJ, to restate some of the wordings in the parentheses. That's my first comment. Second comment is about the last paragraph that we are talking about, the bifurcating issue. Actually, when I read this staff paper, I really like this idea. We haven't talked about it, but financial instrument is getting more and more complex, so that sometimes the prepaid card would include some component of the customer loyalty program, so maybe we have to give some guidance onto that, and this paragraph is giving some guidance on it. So I really like it. So, as many other members said, we haven't talked about it. We haven't considered it in a detail level. So what I suggest is that instead of just deleting whole paragraph, maybe we can ask the staff to analyze this situation a little bit more and talk about this issue later in the meeting, like March meeting or May meeting. That's my second point. And the third point is about the breakage. I really support the staff's suggestion that we have to ask the IASB to think about the possibility of recognizing breakage for the financial liability. I believe that it is a time to think about whether all financial allow breakage or not, so that I suggestions about asking breakage issue to the IASB. That's all.
Okay. But given where we stand, just so that I'm clear, Jung-Soo, given where we stand, would you support issuing the agenda decision?
Tony does not support issuing it.
I see it.
And would you support issuing
it? I support it. But, Tony and also Reinhardt is raising some of the concerns about the last paragraph meeting issue. So maybe we can delay the issuing the agenda decision for maybe one more meeting and think about analyzing the issue a little bit more, because nowadays there are going to be a lot of complicating or complexing issues arises in the market. So it's a good time to think about bifurcating issues.
Okay. Fei Long. Fei Long must be the one who left the meeting. Bruce?
Thanks, Ryan. I'll be honest, I'm just a bit worried we're missing the trick on this. We've been asked a question, and I'm very concerned that where the agenda decision seems to be going is we're suddenly trying to address 10 different things through an agenda decision that really aren't part of the question. I'm fully supportive of dumping the customer loyalty, the last paragraph. I think that I had the same question. I mean, how would you do this bifurcation? And I think that we've got to get rid of that. So my comment on that is I think we should get rid of everything there. We've laid out in the fact that we're not trying to deal with customer loyalty programs. I think the moment we start trying to bring them in, I think we're just going to ask more questions than not. So my suggestion, my vote on this would be I'm comfortable to issue it as is on the basis of the kind of simple facts we've put down there. I'd remove the things around the customer loyalty, and then I'd be happy to support it.
Okay. John?
My comments are fairly similar to Tony's. I mean, I think it is a financial liability. I think it meets the definition of a financial liability in IAS 32, but it is not a financial instrument. It doesn't meet the definition of a financial instrument, and therefore it's outside the scope of IAS 39. I suppose that begs the question then, which derecognition requirements do you apply when you go to IAS 8? Do you say this is a financial liability, and really I go through IAS 8, I end up back in IAS 39 for derecognition, or do I have alternatives as to which derecognition requirements I would apply? So I do think there's actually, I'm not in favor of an agenda decision because I don't think the standards are clear or provide enough guidance on how the derecognition of this liability should be tackled. I'm also concerned that we're trying to add in too many bits and pieces into the agenda decision about the interaction between this fact pattern and customer loyalty programs. I know that we did send a staff off to consider the difference between this fact pattern, which was in the submission, and various different customer loyalty arrangements. But the more I see the amendments and the comments that have come from respondents, the more concerned I am that we're trying to provide guidance without, I suppose, the sufficient consideration of what is the interaction between this fact pattern and various different types of customer loyalty arrangements. So I certainly would be in favour of taking out all of the additions which have been made for this meeting, the last paragraph, particularly about the embedded, you know, where the prepaid card embeds a customer loyalty arrangement or a customer loyalty programme. I think that should be removed. And we should just keep it simple to the fact pattern that was actually raised in the submission. But I do actually think that it's, even though it is a financial liability, I do think that it is not in the, a financial instrument in the scope of IAS 39.
Okay. Sandy?
Yeah, I mean, I agreed with the tentative agenda decision. I had similar comments to Bonnie about the loyalty program and at the last paragraph and that embedded in how you would actually do that. But you know, as I read this, and there's so many different types of programs, and there's so many different nuances to these things. And you know, thinking about this from the perspective, and I understand the literature and the interconnection and the financial liability and breakage versus not breakage, but the reality of it is users of financial statements aren't going to know any of this. They're going to see a liability, and the disclosures are going to be really boilerplate. And so we're dancing on the head of the pin on all of these. And what are people actually really going to see beside a liability, and you know, sort of where it's put on the balance sheet, but how much are they going to actually know about this? How much are they going to know so that they can make a decision about what these should be valued at, i.e. if it's a financial liability and I can't recognize it, maybe I could transfer it to somebody and then, you know, get rid of it. And you know, I'm going to get the fair value of the financial liability, or maybe I'm not if it's not a financial instrument, it's just a financial liability. I guess I'm not clear on that, but I do step back from this and say, what am I going to see, and what do I think these are actually worth? And I don't know the answer to that question, but I know it will be very little. It will be it will likely be just a liability. So it leaves me with how much time should I spend on it, because am I going to come to an answer that's going to matter that much? And I don't know. You know, I'd like to see what people disclose of these things and what they're classified as of now, to know, in fact, if a company I invest in has these, what do I do with this? Or if I have a lot of them, I'm sure I see more of it. But anyway, I interesting technical questions, but what does it all mean in the end that I do with the information or little of it?
Okay. Recognizing all that, the question is, do we issue an agenda decision?
I think we should issue an agenda decision, but I would take out the loyalty paragraph at the bottom, the embedded, because I agree with Bonnie. I highlighted that and said, well, gee, how would we do that?
Martin?
Yeah, I would be supportive with the agenda.
So you agree with the agenda decision?
Decision? Yes, if we take out the links to customer loyalty programs.
Okay, I think that's carrying right now. Bob?
Okay, I'm not supportive of the agenda decision. 4 points I want to make. First, I think Tony raises a good issue we should consider. I'm not necessarily there. I do think that these cards are financial liabilities. I think what the holder has is not necessarily rights to specific goods or services, to a payment mechanism. And I can see how that can be a financial instrument in the scope of 39. But while it might be in the scope of 39, as I had previous meetings, I don't think keeping these liabilities on the books in perpetuity is good financial reporting. And so I'm still a proponent of creating a narrow scope amendment to scope these out of the IS 39 derecognition criteria. requirements. We already caveated an option to the IAS 39. We know that credit loyalty programs, credit loyalty awards, they can be financial liabilities, and we've said, well, you apply IFRS breakage. So why can't we create another scope exception, either similar to what the EITF did, or you think the EITF went too broadly? I mean, we could narrow it to only those cards where the holder can't get cash, but it only has a right to a payment mechanism that can supply them with goods or services. Third point, I think we're creating significant complexity here. One, we don't have refer to customer loyalty programs, and we don't have a definition of customer loyalty programs. Coming back to us and asking another interpretation of what are customer loyalty programs, what are customer loyalty awards. And then we're also creating operational difficulties in that, by the way, and the reason why is because while IFRIC 13 describes them, IFRIC 13 goes away once IRS effective. I think we're also creating operational difficulties in that customer loyalty awards can be either awarded from a sales transaction or purchased. If I think like, for example, airline programs, I can purchase mileage for cash. And so now we're creating operational complexities because now they're going to have to know and track separately those transactions that were purchased for cash, awards are purchased for cash, because they're exactly like these prepaid cards, separate from those that were issued for actually purchasing airline tickets. And then my last point is I think there needs to be some significant edits if we move forward with the agenda decision. Most important, that last paragraph, I'm very confused by what we're trying to get at with that referencing to the embedded within customer loyalty programs.
I think let's take it as given that the last paragraph goes. I've heard maybe Jiangsu, but other than that, no significant support for it. Andrew?
Thanks. Yeah, I quite understand why some folks want to kind of get these out of IAS 39, IFRS 9. But I think they're in IFRS 9. What the holder of this card has is a right to instruct the issuer, the counterparty, to pay $100 or whatever on its behalf. And that feels to me like it's a financial instrument. Everyone's acknowledging there is a financial liability, which I think should be accounted for under the financial instruments guidance, unless another piece of guidance clearly trumps the financial instruments guidance. So it becomes a scope question. If this liability is issued in a transaction within the scope of IFRS 15 or IFRIC 13, then I would agree that that guidance trumps financial instruments, if not financial instruments is the default and should prevail. So overall, I think there is an agenda decision with some appropriate redrafting that that can be issued, and I'd support that course of action. But we had quite a lot of discussion about what we're taking out and references to customer loyalty programs. I do think we need to make the point that some of these types of obligation are issued but are in the scope of other guidance to be able to enable people to figure out which bit of guidance they should be applying.
Okay. Charlotte?
I don't support the issuance of the agenda decision, mainly for different reasons, really. That I think we've skirted around the issue, and the issue is the sort of the overlap between the revenue recognition guidance and the financial instruments guidance. I don't think it's as clear cut as Andrew said that one trumps the other. I mean, I think you could read it that if you're within financial instruments, you're out of the scope of IFRS 15. So, and that therefore you're going down the financial liability route. I quite liked Tony's sort of from PwC's sort of cute way of saying it's not a financial instrument. I'm not sure if I agree, but I don't think it's discussed
I don't think the issue that PwC raised is the one the staff answered, and I think the question comes down: Do you think somebody else has a financial asset? Does it have to be a specific party? Could it just be a potential group of entities that have a financial asset? And then even if you think it's a financial asset, could it be one that's excluded from IAS 39 by being in the sort of the normal usage, normal sales? And I just don't think it's been explored at all. But I do think the important thing is to look at the overlap and see what happens if you have a financial liability where you can't have breakage compared to the sort of revenue recognition guidance which requires you to sort of bring into breakage. I'm also not clear in my mind whether it is a derecognition question or a measurement question on day one, as well as to what you have to measure or how that both those two should overlap. So I sort of said over long, I think we should take it on to the agenda and look at it in more detail, because I'm concerned. I think one comment that Tony made last time, where there were a lot of these issues where there were overlaps or clashes between the two standards, and I'm concerned that they're out there and not being dealt with. And I don't think this would help anyone, really. I don't know anyone who has these specific such a narrow circumstance that this would necessarily help. And just to round it off, I didn't understand the last paragraph at all. I wasn't sure what the definition of a prepaid card was, that I was bifurcating. I've never had to bifurcate something that's not a derivative from something else before. And I just couldn't understand how that would be applied in practice.
Charlotte, I apologize. It appears I was so interested in my scorekeeping that I just missed you altogether. But Philippe, board member privilege. I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
I had a question for the committee. Just changing a little bit the fact pattern, little A, no expiry date. If you change it to a card issuance which has a 5 years life and will expire after 5 years, would the committee reach a different conclusion about the nature of the liability? I assume not. And then my question or suggestion would be, would it make it more useful to readers of the agenda decision or whatever is going to be issued to specify that the conclusions would be the same, absent an expiry date? Because I think there is a broader pattern of facts where you have an expiry date than no expiry date. I think many merchants or many issuers, it's not a merchant here, would issue cards with some expiry dates, which may make the measurement issue more frequent, because then you have the question of breakage, which probably is more important. We have to tackle the measurement issue, because in a way this agenda decision doesn't answer one of the questions: how the entity would account for the unspent balance. And as I read the agenda decision, it says you have to apply the guidance for derecognition if it is IS39. It doesn't tell you whether you have to measure on a basis other than the face value. Some of you have raised the issue of the breakage issue in the measurement. I'm not sure, but it seems to me that to fully answer the question, you would have to address the measurement issue for the period during which the card is issued and has not yet expired.
We had this conversation yesterday. My understanding would have been that measure it at the inbound cash flow, and you don't ever change it until there's an outbound cash flow or it expires.
Yeah, which is a possibility. But I think as a reader of the agenda decision, I would have this question in my mind. I mean,
I think that
if you have a card which expires after 3 years and you reach the end of the second year or the middle of the third year, and you have this outstanding liability, and do you have a question about whether there will be some breakage? And can you take it into account at some point? Or do you have to wait until the expiration to take into account the breakage?
Okay, I have been trying to keep track of this using tick marks, and I'm fast losing control of what my tick marks mean. So let me see if I can draw it back together again. I count 1, 2,
Bonnie Van Etten.
Four.
Has joined the conference.
And maybe Bonnie. I wasn't sure about how my tick marks work for Bonnie. Who would?
I apologize. I've gotten kicked off the everything. So I was trying to get back in.
Okay, I was getting to actually talking about you. So my tick marks failed me if we take as agreed that we're not going to add the proposed final paragraph. Did you support the agenda decision, or were you in Tony's camp?
I'm in Tony's camp. I don't support the agenda decision.
All right, then I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but three of those are for different reasons. Bob says we ought to pursue the narrow scope amendment like the FASB did. Charlotte and Young Sue would bring back the paper. We don't think we've sufficiently addressed one or more aspects, which is the thing that I find most concerning. Especially, I guess, the interactions with 15. We know that there are different derecognition rules between financial instruments and provisions. We've always known that. But I'm concerned about whether or not we've sufficiently analyzed the interactions. So may I make a proposal to the committee that we bring this one back in March, specifically to deal with the interactions with other standards?
Bonnie Van Etten has left the conference.
Poor Bonnie. I don't know what's going wrong in Michigan, but she will bring it back specifically to address the interactions, and I guess any other topics that committee members believe have been inadequately dealt with. Now, and I guess that also includes the possibility, again, of a narrow scope amendment.
We did.
I know we did before, but I think let me find your microphone.
I thought we, in the paper that went through the issues previously, including the analysis of whether there was a financial instrument, it also covered soundings of the board on whether there was appetite for a narrow scope amendment, correct?
Yep.
So we're asking to bring that same analysis back again.
Yeah. Only as a reminder, I don't know that we have new information.
But my recollection was there wasn't much appetite for that sort of amendment, was there?
Okay, so we'll see you again in March. Any objections to that?
It's not clear.
Andrew, you object?
No, I don't object. If we are going to further analyze whether this is actually a financial instrument, I suggest probably it would anyway, that should encompass any broader consequence of getting this out of IFRS 9, IAS 39. I'm a bit concerned about consequences.
I am concerned about that one as well. Specifically, I'm more concerned about the initial measurement. But
I'm not clear.
Yeah, the staff does not have sufficient direction. Let's sit down and talk about it offline.
So the too broad to deal with this issue, including many things embedded as the loyalty program or something.
Well,
and
let's talk about it offline, and I understand your confusion, but I think the specific that I'd like to see addressed more clearly is the interactions with other standards.
IFRS 15?
Yes, specifically IFRS 15, but any others that might come up. Philippe? You're on.
Okay. Maybe the fact pattern isn't clear enough at this stage. I think a question I would have in looking at this transaction is, what is the economic benefit for the issuer of the card? Is it only the interest payment, the interest income on the fact he receives cash before he will disperse the cash? and it is a financial deposit, or does he also earn some commissions from the merchants to which the cards will be redeemed? And that would maybe drive you into IFRS 15 or only IFRS 9, depending on the nature of the remuneration for the issuer.
Tony? They vary, but in some cases, the income is, or actually, in every case, part of the income is breakage.
Yeah, breakage.
In every case, yeah. The economics are at least in part driven by breakage. There's obviously a time value element to it as well. In some cases, there's a commission.
Yeah.
But in every case, there's a benefit from breakage.
Then a question about the scope, whether it is partly in 15 or not, I think depends on the nature of the remuneration for the issuer, which is not very clear in the fact pattern explained here.
That's why I suggested taking out cards that can be redeemed with the issuer, because if they can be redeemed for goods or services with the issuer, that feels very much like it ought to be in IFRS 15.
But even though they are not, I mean, if they can be redeemed only with the merchants, who then will pay a commission for the business brought to them by the issuer of the card, then there is a commission income. This is not financial income in the way of traditional financial income. It is revenue income.
Yeah. All right. We take it as given that the last paragraph goes. Just a minute, Chung. Go ahead, Chung, board member privilege.
Thank you. One question of Tony's. The PWC suggestion is this is not in the scope of IS 39 because this is does not meet the definition of financial instrument. So you are recommending the IAS 8 to develop its own policy. Do you think, do we have anything, if you apply the IS 9, what kind of accounting treatment do you have in mind generally?
Go ahead. Well, I think my sense is that if this is a financial instrument, so it is in the scope of IS 39, IFRS 9, then I understand that the various different views, I understand why people say that that's where it should be, but it would seem to me that that guidance would say that it ought to be, it wouldn't be derecognized until it was extinguished because it had expired. If it doesn't expire, it wouldn't be derecognized. And because it's being looked at as a financial instrument, that it would be looked at as if it was in substance a demand deposit, and Sue can correct me, but therefore it would be measured at the amount that the counterparty could demand. That would mean you wouldn't get to take into account the breakage and therefore lead in some circumstances to it being on the balance sheet in perpetuity. I think if folks were given the chance to develop an accounting policy because it's outside the scope, then they would probably look at it differently. Maybe they would look at the guidance for customer loyalty points. I don't know exactly what they do, but I think it would give them the ability to take into account breakage in measuring the liability that sits on the books. And so I think that's where the difference is set.
Even though there is this is outside of the IS 39. However, maybe some people might say this is quite analogous to their financial instrument in IS 39.
And I think if you were developing a policy, then it's not to me to tell people what accounting policies they might develop. And some folks might decide they wanted to look at it as a by analogy to the guidance for demand deposits. But what we suggested was that there might be another way of looking at it.
Okay, me.
Right, Michael and I have been doing vote counting here. And we have two options. I do not believe we have sufficient support to issue the agenda decision as written, even with the deletion of the last paragraph. So we either bring this back and give it one more try, or we issue an agenda decision that we couldn't reach a decision. Those are our two choices. Because we do have,
eight five, but we don't have what they want.
So we really have
7-5, maybe even 6-6. I count six against. So what do we do? Do we bring it back, or do we issue a decision that says we can't reach a decision? Anybody have any contribution from the online community?
I've got a comment.
Bruce?
As you were saying, Wayne, interesting, I was having exactly the same thoughts. I mean, I guess I'm just trying to sit down here and list all the issues that have come up. And I mean, we're kind of going back to, is it a financial instrument? How does it interact with other standards? Does 15 fit in? Which derecognition? And I guess I'm casting my mind back to when I was first involved in this. And it sounds like we're literally going to start rehashing the same issues. We know that on certain issues like the derecognition, the board's got no appetite to make any changes. So we're not going to win anything there. I guess my problem as well is, as I sit here, I'm not convinced that we've kind of had any arguments that are going to get us back to somewhere different. So I would actually support saying at this stage, guys, this is not something we're going to address. I don't think this is going to be short term. I think by the time we get into the permutations, by the time we get into looking at every one of the issues I've listed here, I think this is going to end up being a very long project, which I'm worried that in a year's time, we're going to be sitting back here and saying, yeah, we can't really come to consensus for an agenda decision on this.
No, we certainly don't want to go there. Nobody wants to devote another year to this. Others in the online camp?
I just want to bring this issue back in March. We've spent a lot of time on this issue and just discarded it. It's going to be too much work. So we give one more try, and if we cannot get any conclusion in March, then maybe we can just close this case.
Okay. Yeah, we do have a sunk cost.
We do have a sunk cost here.
Others in the online group?
Yeah, Wayne, it's John here.
Yeah, John.
I mean, I favor continuing to try to reach isn't there another option that we actually might decide we need to take this on the agenda? I mean, it seems like some members of the committee believe that IAS 39 should be applied to this financial liability, which, I mean, I can sort of understand why, if it's a financial liability, IAS 39 is a logical place to go, but it seems to me that someone could equally argue that it's not in the scope of IAS 39 because it's not a financial instrument, and therefore, even though it's a financial liability, you do have accounting policy choice available under IAS 8. It seems to me that that's going to be a critical issue. I mean, I don't know if it's worth to start doing further. I mean, I don't think the paper had enough analysis of that point, which was raised by PwC, as to whether this is a financial liability that's not a financial instrument and therefore outside the scope of IAS 39. Perhaps that's something worth considering if we're going to analyze this issue further.
That's on my list. I would have
this
to go
Bonnie.
Back
I
would to have my to notes at the time, but I...
My notes at the time, but I...
I don't recall the board exploring the idea of you could have one but not the other. I'd have to go back and check. Somebody was trying to come in there?
Yeah, it was me. I agree with John. We've gotten this far. I think we ought to give it another shot with the staff further analyzing the kind of the approach that Tony mentioned that was in the PwC comment letter, with a bit more analysis to see if there's some sort of basis within the standards. I also kind of agree with Bob that maybe this is some in a potentially ripe for an approach for a narrow scope amendment, similar to what the EITF did. It seems like there's a lot of comments, there's a lot of opinions, and I feel like we've failed the kind of standard community if we don't come to at least some conclusion and provide some level of guidance.
Okay, one last call. Anybody else in the online group or at the table?
Hi, Carl.
Carl?
I also would like to echo John's comments. Therefore, I support the second approach as suggested by you, Wayne.
Bring it back. Am I correct? You would support bringing it back?
No. Not bring it back.
Oh, you would not bring it back. Okay.
No.
Anybody at the table? Andrew?
I would bring it back, focused very specifically on this question of, does the holder have a financial asset, and therefore is there a financial instrument in the scope of 39? I wouldn't particularly support going down the route of exploring a narrow scope amendment, because I just think defining that, capturing what we want to, there are all kinds of things out there, you know, overpayments by customers in the utilities sector, for example, where the same basic question arises. And I think trying to, and if the FASB have done what they've done, but trying to scope this appropriately is not a task to be underestimated.
Okay. Philippe, last call. No, Charlotte, excuse me. Gosh, I'm sorry, Charlotte.
Yeah, as I said, I would support bringing it back to explore that the sort of question of scope. When is a financial liability in scope of IAS 39 versus IAS 18 or IFRS 50? And I wouldn't rule out doing a narrow scope amendment. I think, you know, that should be one of the options open to us.
Sue?
I just wanted to reiterate something Andrew said earlier, which is I think we just need to be super careful of unintended consequences. So if we start making comments here on things being out of the scope of our financial instruments literature, thinking of this very specific fact pattern, the potential knock-on consequences are just enormous. And I'd be very interested to understand why we would reach a different conclusion on what's a financial instrument than what the FASB did, given that my understanding of the history of our scope, etc., was very much came from what was in the US.
And I would have thought.
I'd be very surprised if we should come to a different place, and they felt they needed to amend their literature.
But, well, as I said, in the September meeting, we did explore the argument that if you couldn't find a financial asset, then it wasn't a financial liability in the scope of IAS 39. What we didn't obviously explore was the IAS 8 argument, but I think personally we've already explored the question about, you know, how to deal with it. Is it a financial liability? Yes, and it's in IAS 39.
In the scope of any issue or any project, there comes a point where everybody forgets what we've done. So I think, if nothing else, bringing it back would help us to all understand what we did and what's happened in the past. Henry, without going into detail on 15, am I correct that a customer receivable that arises from a revenue transaction is a financial instrument?
I guess not.
Oh, microphone.
A customer receivable arising from a revenue transaction is a financial instrument, and at the point that it's unconditional as defined by IFRS 15, it would go into IFRS 9.
So if you
do have financial instruments that arise from revenue contracts, and then 15 pushes them to 9.
So the question, though, as Philippe would have said, is the measure, whether at the point that you transfer it, you from 15 to 9, whether you measure breakage in that.
We're talking about liabilities, not assets.
Liabilities.
Yes, yes.
Okay,
yes.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
We're all losing control here. At least I am. All right, we'll bring it back. And we'll sit down, Joan, with you offline and try and define that a little bit. But I do think we've reached the point that it's worth it, if nothing else, a paper that says these are the things that we've already discussed and decided on already. We don't want to go back over those. Are there any new ones? So it may be a very short paper. All right. If it makes anybody feel better, when I sat down with Hans this morning, giving my briefing, that was the issue that I predicted we would have trouble with. You're not allowed to have trouble with any more.
Wayne, sorry, just for a second. This is Pablo on the phone. Can I jump in just for a second to comment on a possible unintended consequence?
Yeah, just real quickly.
Really quickly, yeah. We seem to be accepting the fact that a financial liability can exist without a financial asset existing. And I think Sue was mentioning possible unintended consequences of redefining or trying to redefine what a financial instrument is. I think intrinsic in the definition of a financial instrument is that you cannot have a financial liability without a financial asset, or you cannot have a financial asset without a financial liability existing, because of the fact that a financial instrument implies a contract, an agreement between two parties. So I'm not entering into the debate whether a financial asset exists. I personally think it does. I agree with Bob that the key here is to consider whether this is a payment mechanism, which I think it is. But irrespective of that debate, I think we cannot provide an argument, the committee cannot provide an argument saying that a financial liability exists, but not a financial instrument. Because if there's a financial liability, a financial asset is absolutely necessary.
I understand, and several others have shared the concern. So we'll bring it back.